welcome,
Nate.
Nate,
you don't need to pull it up or Noah is in the room.
We're recording, Nate.
Hey, welcome to the Reflex Blue Show, live from the HOW Conference. I'm Nate Voss.
Studio 280, I am Donovan Beery.
Sweet, we are back, and it has occurred to me we can call it Studio 280 because even though we're totally giving out the room number, this isn't going to air for like weeks.
And people show up here to register anyway.
Apparently,
for some reason.
Oh man, can we just take a moment, and we have a special guest with us, but just let's just take a brief moment. I really want as much of the craziness of yesterday that we wound up recording. I just want to ask you, I really want a lot of that to make the final edit of the show. We had security up in here. We had like the chief of security.
Yeah.
We had
they cleaned the room, and during the cleaning, they took our microphones and stuff, and they were like trying to act like that it wasn't when they switched the room out. I'm sure somebody broke it and stole it.
Right.
So they were checking the lock to see – you know, like when it had been used, if it had been, you know.
What was the last card key to run
through
this lock?
I don't know if you heard, but somebody at the HOW got their iPod stolen from the room.
Oh, man.
Wow. From their room was missing. So I think they're doing the key thing for that.
Man. How?
Don't put that on it.
What's going on? So we had all kinds of people in and out. And then, like, we are, as we were talking about just before we started recording, we are way in the back. Down an empty hallway, there is no sign of life coming this way. We still had a couple people show up yesterday around recording time looking, was like, yo, is this a registration area? And we're like, this is two people in a room, man. No.
Yeah, if we look like we're in charge of registration, it's a sad conference. If you're going to a conference and you see us running the registration desk, you just turn around.
But there wasn't even a registration
desk. We have a
table over there with plastic cups. Like, no, man. This is not where you go to register. Did you see any other living thing for the last 250 feet? No. You had to turn several corners, blind corners. You don't know where they're going.
Yeah, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Right. It's okay. So that was yesterday. Yesterday was great. We did a live recap show that would have aired weeks and weeks ago. And now this morning, we're up, we're chipper, we're doing well, and we're here with Emily Cohen.
Emily, what's your website so people can go check it out if they...
I have two websites because I have two businesses. As I was saying, I have split personality. So the first one is emilycohen.com, emilycohen.com, and then cohenmillerconsulting.com. The Cohen Miller is for in-house people, and the Emily Cohen is for design firms.
Right.
And don't look at both of them. That is against the rules.
Yeah. And they have different design aesthetics depending on the audience.
Right, exactly.
So my Cohen Miller is much more corporate
looking. If you go to it and you don't like it, it's not for you.
Right, go to the other
Close
site.
It, go to the other.
Go to the other one. You'd be like, oh, this is totally what I was looking for instead.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you're here. You're at the HOW conference. You're doing a session. Is it tomorrow?
It's tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Yep.
And that's at the in-house manager.
That's at the in-house. Yeah, but it's kind of geared to anybody, really, but it's mostly to the creative audience. Yeah.
Okay. So give us the brief overview. Like, what is it that you're talking about?
Okay, so I'm talking about managing different generations because I started years ago noticing like a trend in managing staff that everybody was talking about. Oh, those people that are Facebooking all the time, or they wear tattoos, or you know, they work all the time and they never have a life. Or I get emails at 4 a.m. So I started realizing there was this big collide of generations that was happening within at least our profession, but certainly. Any profession. And there was a lot of disconnected communications and struggles. And I thought, this is an interesting topic. And I've been reading about it for years and decided, and it's part of sort of my consulting. And I started researching and thinking, hey, there's a topic here. And so I thought, I'm going to try to do this. So
Nice.
It's exciting.
So like right now, I talk about this on the show way too much, but I just started a new job and I'm at senior art director level and I'm like 32.
Right.
I was born in the late 70s. And, one of my bosses is like probably 50 or 60-ish based on the stories of the ages of his kids, which are my age.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, my dad is that old, so that must then be how old he is. And then the rest of the art direction team, the rest of the design team ranges from like 23 to maybe like 26.
Okay. Right.
And so I'm – so as soon as I saw
so
your
you're
topic,
the old guy,
I was
kind
like
– but not the old
no,
guy.
No, I think I'm the middle guy.
Yeah.
And like my two kind of
you're,
bosses
you're
are
kind of right on the edge of being Gen Y.
Right.
And millennial.
I know. I'm right in between.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily – I haven't picked one yet to say, oh, no, I identify more with this generation. Thank you.
Right. Well, you have no tattoos or piercings.
Right, I don't.
I'm a Gen Xer, I guess.
You are. You're just a little bit older than me, so you're
right.
I think
Gen
you
X,
fall solidly into Gen X.
Right. Oh, I just mixed up Gen Y and millennial, so the same thing. Gen X and millennial, so you're in between those.
Right, right.
I do this all the time.
I don't know if our generation wants to claim
Nate. I think you may have to go to the other one.
I am a man of no home.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I'm between, actually, baby boomers and Gen X's.
Right.
So I'm, like, a little torn as well. But I don't think we have to identify with either one.
I would identify you more with Gen X because aren't the baby boomers more of fuddy-duddies? If I think of the baby boomer generation, I think of the fuddy-duddy.
Yeah.
So, and I don't.
You just called my husband a fuddy-duddy. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that after the show.
She's not saying that wasn't accurate, which, yeah.
Yes, I didn't say that.
Right,
and
right.
He doesn't probably listen to the radio program, so I'm fine with that.
So we've got this team. It's a good team, and I think that we work really well together. I think it kind of happens accidentally.
Right.
So it's everything from, like, and now it is Nerf dart war time randomly. Like, okay, everyone just starts throwing Nerf darts at each other.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, but now it's work time. And it just kind of zips in and out of these, like, fun modes to work modes.
Right. Actually healthy, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I get hit in the face with a dart when I'm not looking for it. But
I think the problem is that most people don't think that's healthy. And there's that struggle between the people, especially at the older generation, or I don't like to say older, or fuddy-duddies. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the baby boomers, they are not used to that kind of environment. They want it.
Right.
And they are inspired by it, but they not used to it. So there's always this kind of, like, pushback on, like, we can't be doing this. We have to have, you know, we have to do work. We have work all the time.
So what are the, like, can we start with, like, the core differences? We've got three groups here.
Right.
And I believe you when you say, like, this happens in offices everywhere.
Right.
Like, this is kind of everyone's environment. I think this is kind of a universal thing that we all deal with in a professional way. So, like, if we were to contrast, you know, the baby boomers with, like, the Gen X and then maybe the Gen X to the
baby
millennials,
yeah,
I like that.
Yeah.
And then let's get the nomenclature. Then let's get the babies with.
I think
with
they're the Biebers.
We'll get the Biebers with the.
There's lots of good names, like
we
boomers.
We will run the Biebers versus the Beatles and do that last.
Don't get me confused. Now I'm already confused.
Okay, yeah. Come on. How many more code names can we come up with? But so, like, compare and contrast for me, if you will.
Okay, well, there's a lot of differences, and that's probably taking a good half of my speech, but I'll try to summarize.
Okay, speech takes place well before this will air. So we're not divulging anything.
Right.
We're not spoiling.
Nope.
Okay.
So at the highest level, a lot of it has to do with what was influencing us during when we were growing up, because that has formed who we are. And I would like to say that this is just generalizations. I don't think, just like you and I are kind of right in the middle of generations, I think generations doesn't always define us. It certainly helps to give a sense of who we are, but it doesn't mean we are that way.
Right.
So, you know, the prejudice against millennials, and there are many from my generation and from, you know, older generation, there's a lot of prejudice against the millennials or the Gen Ys or the boomer or, you know,
the
Googlers. There's all different names for the Google generation.
Well, I just described one of the groups as fuddy-duddies.
Yeah.
So, it apparently cuts both ways.
Yeah, and there's – exactly. And the millennials don't understand, you know, the fuddy-duddies. So it gets really confusing, and it has a lot to do with – you know, parenting styles, what was happening historically, you know, what was going on in the world around us, you know. So, for instance, the Enron generation doesn't trust leaders now because of what Enron happened.
Right.
So, that, you know, they don't like to work with leaders. They have to build trust with them first. So there's that. So it's really interesting how all those things influence. So parenting styles is just an example
of one little thing
that makes us different. And you'll see that. So the millennials, they're called the boomerang generation.
Okay.
Because there's so many different terms, because they basically live with their parents, and their parents are their best friends.
Where
I think, you know, I definitely see that as a common thread. Their parents are their best friends. They get a lot of guidance from their parents. So, you know, I have this great story, if you don't mind telling the story.
Do it. I love great stories.
So one of my clients was a corporate client, had hired, was about to hire a millennial right out of college. Really great candidate, really excited. They asked her what she wanted, and she said something like $35,000. The client said, let me go talk to HR. Mm-hmm. And for you, those who don't know HR, which you should, human relations, HR said, well, we don't have that path the salary path that's open for this position is $45,000. We can only offer $45,000, so $10,000 more. Not a big thing. So she calls the candidate back and says, good news, we can offer you $45,000 instead of the $35,000 you asked for, which, you know, is unusual, so I would say like that's unusual. But the best part...
I do not run into that regularly.
Yeah. But this is corporations. They're silly. They have these structures and pay, you know, salary paths, and they don't see the difference. Like, they have to follow these paths. So the woman, the candidate said, that's great. An hour later, the mother of the candidate calls up to say, like, I don't trust you guys. Who would offer my daughter more money? And was like negotiating on the behalf of her daughter.
For what? For less money?
She didn't trust. She just didn't trust. She wanted to vet where her daughter was going to be working.
Sure.
Because she didn't think she knew and ask questions.
Oh, so, man.
That, another word for that is helicopter parenting.
Yes.
And soccer moms came from that generation. So that's that generation. But the older generation, the baby boomers, were the latchkey generation. So our parents were working 24 hours a day. We were on our own, independent, entrepreneurial, you know, opening the door with our own keys. We were just like, so we are very driven and very focused on work. Work defines us. And as a result, our generation, that was a result of the baby boomers having kids, is Gen Xers are the smallest generation. We didn't have as many kids, so we're the smallest generation. And as a result, we really like that work-life balance because our parents were working crazy hours.
Right, yes.
And so we like that work-life balance. And that's the one thing that Gen X and millennials have in common is that they need that work-life balance. And so there's lots of differences. So it has a lot to do with recognizing these differences and figuring out what are the management styles for that. The other thing is communication is a big one. Tell me if I'm talking too much.
No, you're doing great.
I can talk forever about
this
topic.
We're
going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about proposals. Or we're going to finish proposals and stuff.
We'll finish up this, and then we'll come back again, and we'll do proposals.
Okay.
I think we got a lot more to cover. Checking it out. So, so management style.
Oh, we're back. Okay.
Let's talk about communicating.
No one. Communication. Yeah, we were back after four or five people came in here.
It's down the hall. It's actually, we couldn't be any more opposite. Like, we're up. Registration is underground. Like, it's.
Anyway. I feel we're also in a refrigerator. It's definitely freezing in here.
It did kind of get.
It's
a
the only
bit cold
thing that
can
that keep
break.
Us awake after a crazy night at the HOW conference.
Yeah, apparently. So, we were talking about were just about to talk about communication styles.
Yeah. So communication style is very different as well.
Okay.
So the baby boomers, they like to talk in person, have meetings, lots of meetings. They're very meeting driven. They think that's the most effective communication. Mm-hmm. They don't understand the younger generation. They want to just talk virtually. They want to iChat, even if you're right next door. You know?
I chat with my cube neighbor constantly.
Yes, and that drives the people
right
like
there.
Me crazy. You're like right there. Just talk to them. But that's just how you grew up. You grew up just virtually everything, you know. And Gen Xers are kind of right in the middle. The older ones are really liking meeting face to face, but they're maybe moving more to web and Skyping.
Right, and they might be
a little
more comfortable.
Right.
In between,
right.
but I still have a lot of meetings to go to.
Right, exactly. So it's really interesting how do you deal with that? So when you have a meeting, your meeting-driven culture, you're going to lose a lot of the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to lose their attention. They're not going to pay attention. They're not going to want to go to these meetings. They're going to quit.
They're going to sit there. They're going to hang back.
Right,
ugh.
Right. So
right,
you have to have a good
Facebook
balance and figure out how do they like to communicate. You know, and the other thing is the whole thing about Facebooking, you know, and tweeting and all that stuff. I embrace it. And I think everybody needs to embrace it. And, you know, another great story is I had a client, maybe 20 people on the team, cubicle-driven environment. Mm-hmm. And this is when I started realizing there were generational differences, maybe about 7 years ago. And everybody, when I was interviewing the staff, because what I do is I do staffing evaluations, and I assess their teams and talk about new ways to improve their structures and things like that. And so I was working with him on improving. He was having some trouble with his staff. It was huge turnover, and he couldn't figure out why. Turnover, meaning people quit very easily. And I found out that guys considered paranoid. Like, literally, they thought he was medically problematic, that he was paranoid. And what was the result of this, or what caused it, was that cubicles, open cubicles, obviously, you know, three walls, and he made everybody have their computers facing out so that when he walked the hallways, which he did almost every hour on the hour.
Oh, that's fun.
He could see what they were doing because he didn't trust because they were doing Facebook. He thought that was not productive.
Yeah.
But that's how you guys think. That's how, you know, you talk to each other. And corporations constantly ban this stuff, and you can't. You can't do this because if you ban it, they're not going to want to work there. You know, so you have to embrace it. And as long as they're productive and they get the job done, I think that's the biggest issue, is that they work at different hours. They could work. As long as they get the job done, it doesn't matter.
Right. And that's one thing that I've definitely seen, especially coming into this new position, into this new team. It's like, sure, okay, Nerf Dart War, or like we've got a kind of like a, yeah, it's the open cubicle. Everyone's computers face more or less out. We, you know, our kind of unofficial Facebook policy is like, we're an all digital shop. Of course you're going to be right on Facebook. Of course you're going to be on Twitter. If you're going to be doing it just for you, maybe wait till lunch.
Right.
But whatever.
Right. And I think whatever is the key.
Yeah. But you know, there's like a pool table in the middle, right, and you know, the first couple of weeks for me, I was like, this is nuts. Like this, it was totally not the environment I had ever been in
right
before. And I was like, you know, they're just like playing pool. Like, I know that guy's got work he's got to get done. But like, okay, if that deadline isn't actually till tomorrow and he's totally cool with just sitting at his desk right till 7 tonight.
Right.
And that's the way they do it.
Right.
Like that ability to just like, you know, whatever. I'm going to have fun now and I'm going to, you know, work.
But you also don't
later
know. I think the judgment that you don't know he's not working, because he could be right playing pool and conceptualizing in his head.
I know.
So I think that's the other thing.
I had to go through this process where, like, no, I got to let it go. I cannot be – and, of course, I have to let it go because I'm not in a position to be like, stop playing pool.
Right.
Because then I would be out of there.
Right, exactly.
You know, what I very quickly saw was that, yeah, everyone is still doing great work.
Right.
Everyone is still getting it done on
right
time. It's just not at all what I was used to seeing.
Yep, exactly.
The environments that I was in previous to that were the very rigid –
yeah,
we're going to hold a meeting. We're
right
going to talk about things. We're going to only work. And dear God, don't let anyone
right
see anything fun on your computer.
Yeah.
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 Which is just.
Yeah.
I think it's outmoded. I think you're right. I think that doesn't.
Yeah.
That doesn't actually foster productivity.
No. And it also depends on what you define productivity by, you know. So mm-hmm if you're like a baby boomer, you're defining productivity by the amount of hours you worked.
Right. Right.
Whereas, you know, millennials are defining it by, if I get the job done, I'm productive.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I get the job done, so long as I get it done, you know, and I do it on time and it's high quality, then the work is done. So
yeah, it's like, you know, the idea of I'm being paid to be here from 8 to 5
right
and do a job in that time versus I'm being paid to do a job whenever.
Right.
And I'll just get the job done on
right
time.
Yeah.
But I think both of those can kind of work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And the whole point of when I talk about this topic, because it affects my consulting, is you have to look at everybody on your team and make sure you have a good mix of all different generations, mm-hmm, because you need all those generations. You need everybody to come work together and inspire each other. But it's just like when you manage a team, you should not only look at generations, but look at different personality types.
Right.
You know,
right,
so you have to have the right mix. And that's what I'd love to focus on, is like, do you have like the cheerleader? You know, the person that's always enthusiastic, kind of annoying sometimes enthusiastic. Mm. You know, do you have the tech person? Like, you want to look at your team and make sure you have all the right mix of people.
And I think we could use a cheerleader.
Yeah. Cheerleaders are missing sometimes.
Man, I'm looking around.
Can do it, Nate.
No, I'm thinking about
Nate,
my team.
You can do it.
Like,
right.
Man, now I think I might be the closest thing that we have.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get my face into everyone else's product.
It's usually the one that says,
although,
hey, let's
go. Maybe young Ben. Young Ben is very enthusiastic.
Right.
I'll give him. I don't know if he's good. Ben, I'm calling you out. You're very enthusiastic.
And it might be the person that wants to go for drinks on Friday. You know, it could
yeah
be the team alcoholic. You never know. But it's
everyone on my team apparently wants to drink all the time.
Or both.
Yeah. I wouldn't say you need an alcoholic on your team, but
we do work in an office that has beer on tap 24 hours a day. So it's.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool place to work anyway.
But I think it's harder because you're working out of house, right? So you're working in an agency or a design firm.
Yeah, an agency
now. I think it's harder for people, and where I'm talking at the in-house conference, it's for mm-hmm corporations, because corporations have very strict HR rules.
Right.
And so you have to bend the rules on your team in order to work with these generations. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck. And so you have to be more like an agency. Right. And that's really hard for corporations to accept.
Is it easier if they just don't tell HR what it is they're doing?
Do it and then ask for forgiveness later.
Right, asking for forgiveness gets better results.
Yeah,
than
and you know, honestly, I know that you have to walk the fine line between that. And sometimes when I say that, people kind of object. But you know, I've had clients who painted the walls, even though that wasn't officially allowed or sanctioned, mm-hmm, you know, by facilities management.
Right,
right. So they painted the walls overnight, you know, and then everybody's like complaining, but then they liked it.
Yeah,
and they're like, "Oh, wait, maybe we can do this. How can they get away with it?" So you do things like that without, and we didn't know. I'm sorry, you know.
And other departments are just hanging out in the creative department because it's cooler,
right?
Yeah, not realizing why.
Yeah, so you have to take chances, and I think if you're not a good leader and you're not taking chances, then that's something to think about.
All right, Donovan, I think it's time for break number two, and then I would like to come back and talk about winning pitches.
Oh, so you saw my new website?
Yes. Yes, good. I did.
One of the two.
Yeah.
One of the two.
He liked it.
So I think I saw the right
one.
Yeah, I saw. I guess I saw the right website.
Yeah, yeah.
The How to Win Business website. So, switching gears. Go ahead, Donna.
So, Emily, you actually came and spoke in Omaha. Man, it's been a while, probably yeah. 6-7 years ago.
Oh, wow, yeah, that's when I first met you guys.
Yeah, it was actually before we did before we had a podcast, because obviously we weren't on it.
Yeah.
So we would have tried to Shanghai you.
And, right. We did a lot of that. Yeah, props to AIJ.
You did take me out for beforehand, and we had nice drinks, and we went shopping. So I love that part.
Drew and I did. And I tell you what, the conversations that we had and stuff, and telling us, like, kind of one-on-one, like, how to set up some proposals and how to actually win jobs and how to actually price yourself. Even though I have most likely forgot 95% of it, and thus I've probably only used 3% of what I've been told, it was tremendously helpful, and it's why we wanted to have you in particular on the show.
Good. Well, I appreciate it.
Because it's not necessarily that some projects we probably estimated and got a better rate for, but it's also been a more fair rate so we can continue to work for it. But also the way that we're pitching it to them because of it, I find that we're more receptive and getting – a little bit higher of a, you know, acceptance rate.
Right.
So how – now, you actually – your business originally
I could have used this a year ago. Tag. I wish we had a podcast last time you were in Omaha.
Yeah, Nate would be running like a 400-person agency.
Yeah.
No, so you actually – do you still help companies and design firms write proposals?
I do.
Work?
I do. I have my hands in lots of different pots. But, yes, one of them is writing proposals and pricing – strategies. I don't do new business development, but what I do impacts new business development.
Right.
So a lot of what I have to talk about is, in fact, about winning relationships and projects. So over the years, I've learned a lot.
What's the most common question that people ask you when it comes to how to write a proposal?
That's interesting.
What do you find... are lacking.
I don't know if they ask me questions so much as they, because they don't know what they're doing wrong. I think the biggest thing, if you ask me what the biggest thing they struggle with is winning. I think they keep saying they do these great proposals and they're not winning enough engagements. And so they were trying to, and they think their proposals, okay, let me say this. They say, what do my proposals do wrong? And a lot of times it's not the proposal. And that's that win rate graph is about, it's more about winning proposals, winning projects is not about proposals. It's not even about pricing. I know this is a big one for everybody to hear. But if you are winning projects purely based on price, that's not the way you win projects. The way you win projects is building trust and relationships. So proposals are not meant to qualify clients or to qualify you. If you haven't done the qualification beforehand, then you're not going to win that project. So it's about really building client relationships before you even write the proposal. I think what the biggest problem is people write too many proposals.
Right.
Because designers are – I don't know what it is, but designers are really fearful of confrontation and of honest discussions and talking about money.
Definitely.
But if you talk about that all up front before you put it in writing, you know, talk about who you are, what you are. Like I always say about – you know, when I talk to my potential clients, one thing I always say is, look, I am brutally honest. I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
If you're acting like an idiot, I'm going to tell you you're an idiot.
Right.
You know, and if you don't like that style, then I'm not the right consultant for you.
I love a good meeting like that. We're just not like, no, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
So if you tell them who you are and you're proud of what you do and you show them and you've qualified them. So a lot of times people do these kind of cold inquiries. They get, you know, SEO tells them to go to this design firm, you know, and they call and the design firm just writes a proposal without even calling them, without even just making that relationship. So if you can, at all possible points, make in-person meetings. Now, this might be my generation thing.
Sure.
But having in-person where you actually trust somebody and like somebody and meet them face-to-face. I have a client recently that was having trouble winning this project because they hadn't warmed up the relationship. Let's go on Facebook, see if you guys share friends.
Right.
And they shared 5 friends. Cold inquiry from SEO, just, you know, search engine. And he had 5 friends that they knew in common. One of them was his friend since kindergarten.
Oh.
So that warms up the relationship. Hey, sure. I went on Facebook and I noticed we have 5 friends in common.
Nice.
Boom, they built trust.
Super icebreaker.
I've been stalking you, and here's photos of your kids at your school.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Here's a photo of you dropping off your kid. No.
But, I mean, I think it's really good. I use Facebook with both personal and professional because I think it really helps me to know what's interesting to my clients, what they're doing, what inspires them, where they've visited, how many kids they have. You know, I think that really makes them more human and makes me more human. You know, and they know who I am and what I'm going through, and as a result, we're friends, but professional friends.
Right.
And so then I win more engagements. My clients win more engagements if they build that. So a lot of times it's about writing less proposals and building more relationships, which I don't know why, but designers are fearful of that.
It's a tricky thing, and I think it goes back to the artist inside of us and the fear that you pour your heart into your work,
yeah.
You pour your heart into this project, and oh dear God, what happens,
yes,
if someone says they don't like it?
Right.
I don't think I can handle it.
Right.
And I think a lot of it stems from that, and I've always found it to be one of the biggest roadblocks.
Right. That's a really
possible.
Good point. I actually would say, I would counter that by saying that's actually a really good point, because then what you can do is you're very emotionally attached to your work.
Right.
But if you build a client advocate, if somebody absolutely loves you and trusts you, they're going to defend your work for you. So you wouldn't have to do that. They would be like just as passionate about your work, because they know, they trust you, they loved your work, they've seen the awards, they've heard your clients speak about you. So they know you're doing something smart, and you're a serious designer, and you're strategic, and they'll defend your work. So a lot of times,
I love a good client that will do
but they won't do that if they don't know you.
Yeah.
They will absolutely not do that. So the big, you know, if you look at my graph on my website, the win rate graph, one of the highest ones is having a client advocate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great chart. It's like, okay, you're going to have more success with these things, and then less success with the opposite of that.
Yeah.
You have a client advocate, you're going to have more wins. You don't have any client advocate, you're going to have far fewer wins.
Yeah.
And then the other things like price, they're there. They are way less important.
Right. And I'll say that. I mean, pricing is really interesting. So once you have an advocate, you say, hey, I think this project is X, like whatever price. Mm-hmm. Let's just say number. Don't write this down. $10,000. Let's say you said $10,000. They actually, if they're advocates and they're friends and they trust you, they might say, oh, that's not enough. We have more in our budget.
Oh, man.
And that actually happens more than you think if you trust them.
And a lot of times, I've heard it where they word it like that. I don't know if you're understanding the scope of the project.
Right, right.
The
more
just keyword to crank that price up.
Or you might, did you include 10,000 rounds of revisions, you know, because that's, you know. Or they might say it's too expensive. You know, and that's good. That's the kind of conversations you want before you actually write down the price. Because when you write a proposal,
if every time you were too expensive, they would just say, hey, you're too expensive.
Right.
Can we do anything from there? But one of the worst things in the world is to put together a great proposal or a great pricing that it's like this. No one would call this robbery. We're all feeling good about this price. You send it out.
Right.
2 weeks later, you find out, oh, my God, you're so expensive.
But you have to get to those conversations. And that's the hard thing for designers to do is get to those conversations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, Don.
We do have two more questions.
Okay.
We're going to take a break. We're going to wrap
last
this up.
Break, and then okay, let's do it.
All right. On our last show, we had Bryn Muth on, and she had a question.
I love Bryn.
Hey, I think someone's knocking on the door.
I'm going to check it out. Keep that.
Maybe it's security.
Yeah.
I want to see what this is. Actually, I'm very curious.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Hey,
hi.
We got water. We can register people now. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
All right. So Bryn asks, and we're actually going to lead with this and then just leave the room as she answered the question. We figured this would be it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh, God. We were going to lead with this question.
Right. Okay.
First of all, can I just say I love Bryn?
Who doesn't love Bryn?
Yeah, we kind of figured that's a given. If you've ever met Bryn, you love her.
She's so lovable.
All right. Can you talk about how you have seen the design industry change?
Yes.
Because she was saying you guys are of the same, I guess, generational.
Yeah.
Let's say generation. That's a great way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she's younger than me, but okay. How has it
generations
changed?
Generations have a range.
Yes.
The same grouping.
I feel as young as she is. Okay. So... Oh, there's so many different things. I think that obviously the type of work we do changes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what we're doing now is more consultative than it is. Here's my thing. Okay, let me go back to that, which is I actually think the world is design is dividing between two groups, the strategists and the doers, the executive executioners. And there's a real need for executioners. Those are the people that do newsletters and kind of execute off templates, or there's not a lot of high-level strategic thinking.
Yeah, I think we usually call that like the production work.
Yeah,
the
but work it's there's still design work, like PowerPoint presentations, things that maybe are not high-level but still need to get done. It still need to look good, but they're not strategic. And so a lot of design firms specialize in that. And it's all about getting things done fast, quick, and about budgets. Mm-hmm. A lot of my clients are leaning towards strategists and not even doing execution. A lot of my clients are leading to be more strategists, and advisors are consultative. So they're not even doing execution.
Right.
They might be outsourcing it to lots of design firms. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're thinking at the biggest picture. I have one client that is a communication strategist and works with institutions at the very early stages of what kinds of communications they need, doing evaluations of communication audits and signage audits and wayfinding audits, and kind of coming up with a strategy and then getting design firms to execute against that strategy. Mm-hmm. I've seen that in a lot of different parts of the industry. People are leaning towards more of that stuff. You know, user interface strategies. They shouldn't be doing programming. Programming is purely executional. So separating your firm out from not doing programming and just simply doing the high level thinking, you know, about the site architecture and the wave, you know, the wireframing,
user experience,
yeah. All of that. And you know, the programming, yes. I'm not saying programmers don't have value, and please, you know, don't misunderstand me.
Oh, man, no. But I think they have tremendous value.
Yeah, they're
value,
tremendous.
Yes.
And any good programmer is going to be great at UX as well. They're going to have some insight about that stuff, but they are purely executional, or at least they're envisioned as executional.
Yeah.
So that changes your pricing strategy as well. So I think that's definitely one of the trends, is that our world is kind of splitting in two, and eventually it's going to be two separate industries. I really do think that.
I would absolutely believe that.
Yeah.
I think eventually, yes.
There's
already a big divide, and it wasn't super obvious to me. It's obvious to me now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I work with, you know, like I have a core creative team that is part of a larger like group, and that group includes like creative and accounts, and that's kind of like your traditional advertising model, even though we're all digital. And then we've got user experience, we've got the technology team,
right.
And those guys are. I like to describe them as like they're like the characters from the Big Bang Theory,
mm-hmm.
From that show, because they're just wicked, wicked smart, and they
right.
like what they know how to do is they know how to make things,
right.
And they know how to make things that people are going to enjoy using,
right.
And then we have like the strategy and then like design
yep.
execution on our team, and
yep.
it's, everything that we do now is about making those
yep.
kind of two sides work together.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's also the other thing that's the trend is. And this is a little bit related to the strategy thing is that designers are no longer just visual thinkers. They're editorial thinkers as well. So when they go to a design firm, they want editorial strategy. They're asking you to help name products,
yep.
how to name restaurants. They're asking you to develop taglines and positioning strategies and messaging. That, 10 years ago, didn't exist. They didn't ask designers to do that stuff.
Right.
You know, and so that's really exciting change, is that clients are partnering with you and getting more of an integrated experience. But if you don't have that skill set, that's going to leave you in the executional mode. So you have to really expand your resources and expand your skill sets to be able to provide a range of different kind of visual and editorial solutions to your clients. So
man.
It might not be writing, not necessarily specific writing, but really high-level editorial thinking.
Man, I hope that answer is good enough for Bryn.
It's good enough for me. So the next question we have for you is, our next guest will be Michael Osborne from Michael Osborne Design in San Francisco. Do you have any questions for him?
I do. First of all, I think he's one of the three Michaels, and he might hate me saying that. But I'm
him,
always
him and Jackson and Jordan,
Vic. No.
So I always this might be also a generational thing, but I'd like to know what you think of design heroes and how important they are now, because I think that a lot of younger people are not knowing who the design heroes are and are not inspired by design heroes, and are they essential anymore? Like who is his design heroes? Do you think you need design heroes coming into the industry?
God, I want to talk about that for like the next hour.
Well, who are your design heroes?
Oh, I have so many.
Yeah, but is
and
that
I wonder
anymore?
If I'm a little prejudiced by my clients, but I would have to say Louise Feely is definitely mm-hmm. one of them. Absolutely one of them. Alina Wheeler, don't know if a lot of people know her, but she's written some great books on brands, and she's been a mentor of mine for a very long time. Mm-hmm. If you don't know her, look up her books. They're fabulous. Moira Cullen on the in-house version, because she's done some amazing stuff in-house.
Yeah, she gave a pretty good show yesterday.
Yeah, so I have lots of design heroes
But and that even to me now relates back to what we were talking about earlier, like with the attention span of the millennial generation, like do you have a design hero?
Yeah.
Or do you have a really cool thing that you saw that someone
yeah.
did and
you've
then you
blog.
Move on?
And I think
and
that's
you move
it.
On to
you've got a blog
else.
For the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool thing for the day.
Yeah.
No one blogs anymore, man.
I blog.
We don't even really blog anymore. We just say we have the show.
Well, you know, because I teach at FIT and
mm-hmm.
I'm really amazed.
What is a
Fashion Institute of Technology
okay.
in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They have a design program, a graphic design program that I teach professional practices in. And I'm really amazed. When I went to school, and this is definitely a generational thing, I knew everybody who was hot. I wanted to work for all. All they know is Stefan Sagmeister. That's it. Yeah. It's like the whole world revolves around him and nobody else.
And he hires a total of one person and an intern.
Yeah, and they're lined up for years in advance. Like, to be an intern at that place, is you can't even get in. So, you know, I just think that's terrific that these young designers don't know other people out there who are amazing. And the only reason they like him so much, besides obviously he's a nice guy and great work, is because he takes these sabbaticals. And they love that idea.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not a business model for everybody.
No,
you know?
Not at all.
You know, so, and he's built a whole career around this kind of, you know, and I think people need to know who other people are out there that are inspirational, whether it's their lifestyle or their work, but they need heroes.
All right. Well, let's leave some of this question for Michael Osborne to talk about. Yeah. But
and his answer will be Stefan Sagmeister.
Yeah. Oh man, I love.
Oh, I'm gonna call it.
I love Sag. Okay, but okay, so don't telegraph that at all, and we'll see. We'll see. Sagmeister's the best. I can't really think of anyone else.
It's the only guy I even know in this industry.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Emily, it's been so great having
Thanks
you on the show.
Thanks for having you guys. It's great. It's good.
It's
Thank
been
you
really
very
awesome.
Much.
Have a great session tomorrow at the conference, and I hope to talk to you again
this
soon.
This is actually great because it was a warm up because it reminded me of what I'm talking about.
Right, yeah. Okay, now you're psyched. It's going to be 10 times better.
Like, I think I know what I'm doing.
We can probably just get you an advanced cut of this recording. Yeah. You can just play it instead
that
of actually
cool.
doing it.
That would be cool. Yeah, I'd like that.
So I did the show.
We can, you know, get hungover, sleep, and whatnot.
Or just.
Yeah,
catch up on some emails while the audio is playing.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks for listening. You can leave questions, comments, 36point.com.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks very much.
And you guys are welcome to email me if you have questions as well. So.
All right. At one of our 18 websites. Yeah. 47 websites.
It's easy. Wait, no, let's Emily at EmilyCohen.com.
Yeah, okay. So Emily at EmilyCohen.com. Throw it out there. Yeah. And great. We'll see everyone soon.
Cool.